It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the NCAA agreed to a legal settlement that could change the character of college sports.
The agreement is subject to approval by a federal judge. It includes over $2 billion to be distributed to former college athletes. Those athletes weren't allowed to be compensated for their name, image, and likeness under previous NCAA rules.
It also lays out a framework for college athletics programs to start paying athletes directly in a revenue-sharing model. The proposal centers on top-tier athletic programs and conferences known as the Power Five.
It could upend the amateur model of college sports, but college administrators and athletic directors are still working through how these changes will affect their operations.
Matthew Mitten teaches amateur and professional sports law. He's here to walk us through the potential impact of this deal. He's professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. Matt, thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rob.
On top of what we already had with name, image, and likeness deals allowed for players now, how big a deal could this settlement be in the landscape of college sports?
Well, it's a seismic change, and there's really very uncertain consequences. There's a lot of details to be worked out. This is unprecedented territory. And, you know, the first step is going to be whether Judge Wilken, approves the settlement as is or insists upon certain changes.
What stands out to you as the biggest change this could make in college sports, especially, as I mentioned, for those Power Five programs?
Well, the question is, the athlete, I don't have a problem with, athletes getting a slice of the pie, so to speak, but it's really just intercollegiate athletes in two sports, football and men's basketball, that generate the lion's share of the revenues. And as I understand this proposal, there would be, up to, roughly 20 to 22 million each year that each Division I school could basically revenue share with athletes. But the question is, well, how do you do that? Is it going to be just athletes in certain sports? It can't be just male athletes who get a share of the revenues because of Title IX, which requires gender equity. The question is, what about those who generate, more of the Olympic sports like wrestling, gymnastics, those types of sports? Are those going to be eliminated? It's going to be, how does that money get allocated among each university's intercollegiate athletes? And is it going to result in the loss of some intercollegiate athletic sports at certain schools?
I counted up the Power Five programs here in Wisconsin, and if I got my count right, Matt, it was one, UW-Madison. Is that where we're going to see the biggest impact potentially?
Well, the question I look at, being at Marquette, let's take the best men's and women's basketball player coming out of high school. And obviously, UW-Madison generates more revenues through their athletic program because they're a member of the Big Ten and they get a pro rata share of, the conference generated revenues, which is largely, by football. Marquette doesn't have a football team. So, Wisconsin, I don't know, they probably generate more than $100 million in athletic department revenues. And, they're going to be able to offer potentially both the men's and top men's and women's basketball players in the state more on an annual basis than Marquette can. And that's going to lead to some competitive balance issues. If we compare this to the professional leagues like the NFL and the NBA, there's a cap. There's an amount, and then there's, pro rata revenue sharing. So that's how the Packers have been able for years to compete very effectively with larger market teams like the Vikings, the Lions, and the Bears. And this system that's set up now is not like that. So that's really my concern, is going to be how it's, one of the things is how it's going to affect competitive balance. It's not just the Power Five football and basketball teams and other sports that compete against themselves. They compete with others like Marquette and UW-Madison compete on the playing field in a number of sports.
Yeah, UW-Green Bay's women's basketball team has had great runs. Marquette's men's basketball team. Do you worry that not just in Wisconsin, we're going to see a haves and haves not thing where there's just no competition like that. It is just this exclusive club of these big schools.
Well, I think that's exactly the case. NCAA generates the lion's share of its revenues is from the men's basketball tournament media revenues. And that's all of Division I. That's roughly 350 schools. But within that, there's only, roughly 70 schools that are members of what are now Power Four conferences, with the Pac-12 just being two schools. Now, there's going to be very significant revenue disparities generated by athletics just within Division I. Even within football, if we take the Big Ten, I'm an Ohio State alumnus. Ohio State generates, more revenue than anyone else in the Big Ten. And they've actually got a bit of an advantage over their fellow Big Ten schools when it comes to it. So, this could really lead to competitive balance issues, fairness issues. How are you going to comply with Title IX? There's just a whole lot of details that the settlement agreement doesn't address.
We're talking about the NCAA agreeing to a legal settlement that would allow colleges to pay its athletes directly, still subject to approval by a federal judge. Marquette University sports law professor Matt Mitten is with us. Let's take that down the road now, Matt. Suppose the judge signs off on this deal, more or less as written. If you're an athletic director, say, or a board of regents, what are the next steps in figuring out how this works in reality?
Well, I think the first thing that you're going to look at is determine, what's going to be the mission and objectives of our athletic department. And the question is going to be, are we able to, generate the revenues that we need to compete at the level that we want to offer the number and quality of sports that we want in our particular athletic conference? So we might see another round of musical chairs where, up or down. Some schools might look at it and say, we want to compete at the highest level, and we're not in the right conference to do that, so we're going to try to move. Or some schools, potentially some Big Ten schools, could say, geez, we're just not going to be able to generate the revenues to compete at this level, so maybe it makes sense to move somewhere else. Now, of course, regents, alumni, others, might not like that, but I think there's going to have to be some very careful consideration that each athletic department, university president, chancellors, boards of trustees are going to have to consider is take a look at really the economic realities and determine what makes sense for their particular university.
And then also the equity issues you mentioned. Does the football player get paid and the wrestler not get paid? Does the men's basketball starting forward get paid? And the women's basketball starting forward, get paid less? How are they going to have to sort those things out?
Well, those are going to be difficult issues, because if you look at it, let's just compare, most schools offer both men's and women's basketball. Mm-hmm. And the men's basketball generates more revenues, historically been, more popular, bigger media contracts. But women's basketball really on the rise. It's great to see that. And you've got a real equity issue. If you say, okay, collectively we're paying our 15 men's basketball players, let's say $3.5 million. How do you justify paying the 15 female basketball players less? Because Title IX doesn't say, it just says there's one pot and there's got to be equal athletic participation opportunities, benefits and treatment proportionate for both genders. And, that's going to be a very difficult issue to work out. Probably not as much of a concern if you have, a football player getting more than, let's say, a male wrestler, because there you might be able to justify it. It's that, football generates more revenue than wrestling, for example. But then you might see some schools say, why should we keep the sports at the intercollegiate level, which aren't generating enough money to pay for themselves? I would hate to see it go to, it's just schools keep the revenue generating sports, enough sports to comply, female sports to comply with Title IX, and then move everything, others to a club sport model.
One
that could happen too.
one interesting wrinkle, as I understand it, this settlement would say athletes, even if they're getting paid, they're not employees of the school. But hang on, we've got a couple schools, I think Northwestern and Princeton, where some athletes are unionizing saying, yeah, we're kind of employees. How does that all factor in?
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing. You know, on the one hand, if you're getting paid for your playing services, which they would be, mm-hmm. you know, let's face it, on the one hand, it makes it look like, well, that's closer to the professional model and their employees. And if athletes at a particular school want to unionize, they should be permitted to do so. But on the other hand, there's a whole host of things that come with unionization. And right now, under federal labor law, it would only be potentially athletes at private universities, not public schools. Whether they could unionize would depend upon their particular state's law. And of course, you have, you know, roughly half of the 1,100 NCAA schools, public, half are private. It's unlike, you know, the NFL, where, you know, the players of all 32 teams, they're all private. They've all unionized, collectively bargained it. I don't think that's a particularly good model to go to. But now, you know, that issue is still on the table. It's unresolved.
The big question mark, Matt, in our last few moments, we've got a federal judge who has to sign off on this. Do we have any sense of the timeline when we'll have that decision? By, I don't know, the next football season, maybe?
Well, maybe by the end of the year. You know, the judge is going to solicit, you know, anyone who wants to can comment. I mean, you've got 1,100, you know, but NCAA member schools, you know, 350 plus at the division level. You know, everyone's going to have different views, and there's going to be a lot of commentary and briefing that the judge is going to have to consider. You know, maybe she is able to give her initial opinion by the end of the year. And I wouldn't be surprised to see an appeal. This could be potentially something, you know, the fairness, reasonableness of this settlement that could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Matthew Mitten, professor of law, executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School.
Just ahead, a group of Wisconsinites with differing views on abortion listen and learn from each other and craft policies on women's reproductive rights. We hear from two participants in the Citizen Solutions Project coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Imagine having a seat at this conference table. 14 strangers from around Wisconsin charged with crafting policies on women's reproductive rights. 9 members at the table are pro-choice. 5 are pro-life.
The group known as Wisconsin Citizen Solutions on Abortion and Family Well-Being assembled earlier this year as an experiment. Can people who come from all walks of life find solutions to divisive issues even when they disagree?
The national group shepherding the program guides members to build trust and ultimately put forth policies for lawmakers to consider. They're now seeking public input in the process. We hear from two of the participants. Kai Yael Gardner-Mishlov is executive director of Jewish Social Services of Madison. And Bria Halama is a licensed clinical mental health counselor in Port Washington. Kai and Bria, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Kai, you are pro-choice. What do you learn about being part of this process?
Well, the process was very interesting and very rewarding. Basically, in this process, you know, I learned that different people are bringing different perspectives to this issue and ways of in which to navigate some of our differences. We were all coming with divergent opinions that could be quite contentious at times, you know, especially out in the general public. But really, once you get to know other people and understand their circumstances, once we start to step outside of our own echo chambers, there's a way that we can work together to come up with solutions. Because sometimes we're disagreeing about topics, but there's something underneath that topic that we can work on together.
This was several days of civil conversations. Bria, you are pro-life. What came up for you?
So much came up for me. And just to echo what Kai was saying, definitely learned so much. And when you asked that question, what came up for me, I think what I noticed there is all the things that came up during this process of my defenses of, you know, maybe some of those perspectives that I had of like, okay, you know, they're wrong, I'm right. How am I going to show them, or how am I going to get my point across? And as a therapist, I do a lot of work with people in helping educate them with this perspective of, our defenses and how we get hurt in our lives. And so then we develop these self-protection mechanisms and, you know, in order to keep ourselves safe. And so often that's keeping people at a distance. It's keeping us from living our lives as freely and to be able to love and to move forward. And so I was noticing a lot of those places in my own heart of where I was judging other people, of where I was getting defensive, where I was seeing these people as a threat to my own safety and my own belief system. And so through the process of, these couple of days, I really was able to sit with, wow, actually these are really wonderful people and I'm learning their stories and I'm hearing them out. Can I see them as beautiful individuals? Can I see them each as a gift and somebody that I can learn from? And can I find myself in a place of safety to where I can actually receive what they can teach me and actually receive who they are? So I learned so much about myself in that process. And of course, learned so much about other people and how to engage in these kind of really difficult dialogues.
Oh, in a place of safety to receive, to be open. Kai, you know, when you consider what people were bringing to these conversations, their own trauma, their own experiences, their own biases, when you consider like you're trying to build consensus, is that realistic? Is that achievable when you have all of humanity to consider here in what they bring to the table?
I think absolutely it's possible to attain, you know, consensus. Maybe it's not necessarily the consensus that you may have started out wanting when you first joined the process, but that doesn't mean that you can't agree on something. You know, as Bria was stating, and as you also reiterated, a lot of folks were coming with trauma, their own trauma or trauma that they had observed. And so because of that, they are navigating their own trauma and in the ways in which they are navigating issues with other people. And so if you take the time to get to know someone else, to realize your own biases and look at what can we work on commonly, if we can say maybe we can't agree about whether someone has the right to abortion or not, but can we agree that there are factors at play that prevent women or folks of childbearing age and people, families from thriving in this community? So what can we do to ensure that there are healthy outcomes? Because it's not only about abortion, it's also about the health outcomes, the poor maternal and fetal outcomes that a lot of communities are experiencing. So how can we support them?
Bria, the policies the group came up with included things like expanding Medicaid to mothers 12 months postpartum and ensuring sex education in schools. The group couldn't find that common ground on abortion access specifically. Is that a concern that the group failed to come to a consensus on abortion policy?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily see it as a failure. I think in the midst of it, it probably felt like that. I mean, we were frustrated. We were trying our best to be open and to hear the others out. But yet, there were these defenses in us and, you know, postures at times where we were like trying to win. Like there was a competition that, you know, I think a lot of us could feel in that. So it definitely was not easy. It was messy. A lot of uncomfortable emotions. But I think something that I learned in this is that this issue of abortion, this issue of life, of bodily autonomy, the moral issues surrounding this, it's so complicated and it's so deeply sensitive on so many levels. I mean, we're talking about some of the deepest aspects of our identity as humans are at play here. And so I think it was something that I learned so much in that process, that there's so much surrounding it than I realized. And, you know, like the policies get at some of those issues. Like, we need so many other ways to support women and families and children. And so, yeah, I think I just learned how complicated the issue was. And I was very proud that even though we couldn't come to a consensus, that we were able to see each other, understand each other, hear each other out. And I think at least my heart expanded in how difficult this conversation and this issue is. And it's not going to be a black or white answer, but the hopefully the goal and the progress will come in coming together and having discussions and just understanding the other human beings around us and what their needs are and what their experiences are.
Were there times where you could feel, Kai, that the group found some common ground?
Definitely. There were times when folks were sharing their stories, some of the stories that they experienced or either stories of folks that they knew they were aware of were very traumatic. And in that trauma, I saw a lot of care and concern and respect being extended between people who might have been sitting at opposite sides of the issue.
Were you surprised at all by what you heard of these personal experiences, Bria?
I guess surprised, would be a word that would describe it. But I think just so deeply moved at the vulnerability, at people being able to share about their experiences with a group of strangers. And, you know, there was a motivation, I think, in if I share this, like I want there to be a change here. Like, I hope that me sharing this will bring about something positive for our state and for, you know, even just the 14 of us. So deeply, deeply moved by the trauma, by the aches, the longing, the suffering. And so it was something that was so beautiful was how we grew as a group. Like, yes, the goal was to come up with proposals to find common ground, but it was amazing to see how we grew in relationship with each other and how when people were sharing, we were able to just be present and just hold each other's hearts and hold the space and just really reverence each other. I was deeply moved by the whole experience in that.
Yeah. Kai, during the process, can you recall a profound or really memorable moment that sticks with you?
You know, the memorable moment that I experienced was witnessing folks from different, opposite ends of the spectrum, talking to each other, hugging each other, and sharing their trauma together. That was very memorable to me because I'm not sure that that would have happened outside of that room, because there are a lot of assumptions that we may make of folks who don't believe in the same, don't have the same world philosophy that we have.
Kai Yael Gardner-Mishlov is with us, and Bria Halama, they're participants in the Wisconsin Citizens Solutions on Abortion and Family Well-Being. As we examine this experimental program, came to Wisconsin to find common ground on reproductive rights policies and on the issue of abortion. Do you feel this process has changed you in your approach as a counselor, or how you view people who have a different perspective? How it might change in your career?
Oh goodness, yes. This, I will count this as one of my most life-changing experiences. Something that comes to mind with that is a moment where I don't recall who even said it, but someone said something along the lines of, like, why aren't we trusting women, or why can't we trust women with their own choices? You know, so someone from the pro-choice side had said that. And that moved me in such a deep way and in such humility, because I realized how much that's been important in my own story of being trusted. Because there are times when I think, like, I'm not trustworthy or I am not enough, you know, some of those lies that come up. And I thought about with my clients, how much of the work is showing them that they're trustworthy and showing them that they're good and guiding them to trust their own heart and that they have what they need within them to heal and to grow and to be who they want to be. And so it really shifted my mindset and how I approach my clients and coming from that not judging perspective, because I don't know all of their story and I hope to hear more about their story and where they've come from so that I can work with them. But in coming to that posture of trying to trust that they know what they need within them. And even though I come from, you know, my own religious affiliations and perspectives and values and things, that to have such a respect and an honor for their free will and their hearts. And so coming from a religious perspective, I mean, that really challenged me. Hmm. And it's challenged how I view my perspective as someone who's pro-life. And it didn't change how I view the dignity of human life and believe still in those pro-life values. But it did shift me into thinking, how am I then loving and praying for and receiving women who have chosen abortion? Can I still absolutely like love them and have compassion and have a heart of understanding for them? So it really stretched me in that way. And I think has really affected how I do my work as a counselor.
Kai, what comes up for you on the ability to trust and to hear and to place value on the role of trust in people's lives?
That's very much a part of my viewpoint, especially as someone who is pro-choice. I think that we have to trust women or the pregnant person and their healthcare provider and whoever is their spiritual advisor or their faith background to make these sort of decisions. For me, working with an agency that provides support to vulnerable communities and assisting them in navigating all of the barriers that exist, I question what purpose does it serve to place more restrictions that will, you know, really affect communities that are disenfranchised even more. So if the purpose is to trust women and to trust communities to make the right decision or the decision that's right for them, then how can we make that possible for them?
There were health and legal experts, there were policy experts mediating the conversations, helping to guide the conversations a bit, keeping them on track, I would imagine. What strategies are they bringing to the table, Bria, to help guide the discussions?
I think that they did a really beautiful job. I found them to be very trustworthy in all that they did, and they had just a good plan and how they came at this. Yeah, they had several points where we would just be spending time getting to know each other. Like when we would share meals together, they would shift who sat where and maybe have some talking points or, you know, a goal for this meal is to find out this from the people sitting around you or things like that. So kind of broke down those barriers of, you know, you're this, you're that, you're pro-life, you're pro-choice kind of a thing. And then throughout the process where we were sitting down at the meeting table, they did some education on how to come to solutions, you know, how to develop a value statement, how to find common ground in these contentious issues, what's the posture of kind of your mind and heart as you engage in these things. And so just some different pieces of education there that were really helpful to guide us and to really honor each other throughout the conversations.
Bria, sharing a meal together, was that helpful in breaking away from these really difficult conversations, but then to have this spend time with people around shared food?
Oh, it was lovely. I mean, there's something so communal and connecting about sharing food. I mean, there's so much to that through so many different cultures. It's so beautiful. But I remember one of the meals I was sitting, there was four of us at one of the tables within the larger table. And we all ended up ordering off the menu as if, you know, oh, if you order this, then what we can share. And we ended up sharing all of the things. And so we were passing it around. We were preparing bites for one another with all of the different, you know, parts of it. And it's like, we totally forgot who was coming from what side. And we were sharing stories about vacations and memories and, you know, the meaning of things for people. And it was just delightful. You know, we're just laughing and just like, blessing each other. It was wonderful.
Kai, what do you hope comes of this work?
I'm hoping that this work will continue. I mean, we spent a couple of days together undergoing this process, but this is something that needs to go on. It needs to be ongoing no matter what the issue is. And I think by doing this, by accepting other folks and really listening to a different viewpoint than your own, it's helpful because it enables you to see the humanity in someone else and also to see where there might be common ground between the two of you. So my hope is that this can continue, that more people will participate, and that Wisconsinites will actually go to the website, the Citizen Solutions website, and weigh in on some of the proposals that we were able to come to consensus about. It's very, very important to understand that, also to not label folks, to understand that someone may be labeled as pro-choice or pro-life, but there's a lot of gray area in between those two terms. And a person that may be pro-choice may share some of the feelings that someone who's pro-life or some of the same opinions. So how can we go move beyond the labels and work together to really create a society that's safe and healthy for the most vulnerable in our community?
Kai and Bria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Kai Yael Gardner-Mishlove and Bria Halama, they are participants in the Wisconsin Citizen Solutions on Abortion and Family Well-Being. The group of 14 Wisconsinites with differing views on abortion came together to craft reproductive rights policies. The public input session closes Wednesday, and you can find a link to participate at wpr.org/WisconsinToday.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Milwaukee theater group gets an infusion of funds to develop plays that bring visibility to disabled actors and artists. We'll learn about Pink Umbrella Theater Company and its work to change Wisconsin's theater industry. That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about recycling prized possessions.
When someone downsizes their home, they have to think about what stays and what goes. But what do people do with relics from their life that carry deep meaning, like old trophies? At the Nationwide Trophy Recycling Program in Madison, staff and volunteers take old trophies for a fee and recycle the parts. Then they rebuild new trophies and give them away for free to nonprofits nationwide. Alexandra Salmon takes us on a tour of the shop.
And then as we got over here, we've just passed all the boxes, a huge mountain of boxes that started back in 2020.
This is Janet Gray, co-founder of the Nationwide Trophy Recycling Program. She used to keep the recycled trophies at her other family business called Total Awards and Promotions, but eventually they ran out of space.
And we just couldn't keep up. Once COVID came, we as a family couldn't keep recycling. It was growing so much, as I said, the hallways, every single office. So we actually had a moving company had to move all those boxes over to here. And then the boxes just kept coming, so it got higher and longer. As I said, that was my load from today. I just picked that up from UPS. And so we keep doing the new stuff. So that's why we're finally getting down to 2020 and 2021.
So I'm really curious about this, how people are basically paying to give you their old trophies. And obviously that's people's time and they're spending money to give their old trophies to you. And I'm curious, what do you think drives people to give you their old trophies?
What people are doing is a sense of feeling of honor. These awards have honor and feelings with them. They just can't take it to the garbage. Now, sure, they could take it to Goodwill. Goodwill's going to sell them in their stores, so they're going to take their plates off. They want to feel better about this. This is another step going forward to say, you're not going to just throw them away. You're going to give them to somebody else to feel that honor. You're going to pay it forward. So it's those who really want to see their trophies go and have another life.
Okay.
It would go like this.
Here's Nancy Haight, a volunteer.
And so what are you doing right now?
I'm taking apart a trophy. This is a plastic, an old plastic base. And we'll look at it, see if it's worth a saving.
So do you have any memories of getting trophies?
No, I'm too old.
Female softball? Because you love female softball trophies.
No. Women, when I was in high school, did not play sports.
So there were no trophies exchanged?
No. No, there were not for women. We did not play basketball. We did not play track. We were too feminine, and that was bad for your body, I guess.
Oh, I can imagine. Do you like to get recognition now?
Oh, I did. In my profession, I did. You would get plaques. You belong to an association that would recognize you. So, yes.
And did that feel good?
Oh, yes, it sure did. It felt like you did a good job at what you were doing.
What do you think trophies mean to people?
Again, I think it's about the honor and the feeling of being appreciated or of accomplishing something. People need to be recognized. You see, you're going to stand up real straight when you've been appreciated. You've done all this work and they love you for it. And that is what people feel when they get awarded with something, I think, is the appreciation. You can feel it.
Yeah. And why do you think we need that?
Probably because being that I was raised in the awards business, I really feel that people need appreciation. It's your motivation. So I think that appreciation is missing in our society. We just take it for granted. And that it's just like a little gem. You can appreciate it and you light up like a light bulb.
Alexandra Salmon is an independent radio producer who lives in Madison. She brought us that story on recycling trophies. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
Millions of Americans live with a disability, but according to the Actors Equity Association, theater actors with disabilities are awarded a small fraction of contracts. A Milwaukee-based theater company prioritizes making theater accessible and inclusive to actors and artists with disabilities.
The company recently landed a grant to create more plays focused on representation and expanding theater to include disabled actors and stage crew. Katie Cummings is founder and executive director of Pink Umbrella Theater Company in Milwaukee. Katie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
You founded this company in 2018. So why create a theater company that focuses on employing and really lifting up artists with disabilities?
Oh my goodness, that's such a big question. But why is because it is about time that the stories that are thought of and represent the disabled community are brought to light and represented by actors and artists who identify and live within that community. Theater is big enough for everybody. And there was a moment in 2018 where I was like, why is this not happening everywhere? So I started it here.
What was that moment, that pivotal moment that you came to light that there was this really underrepresented piece of the theater community, the theater industry?
Yeah, so a few things kind of converged that year. One, I was at that time the Academy Director at First Stage Children's Theater in Milwaukee. And we, my colleague Jennifer Adams, started a program in 2012. And by 2018, we had over 200 or 300 students that had aged out of that program, right? First Stage, it's a children's theater. And we had many, many of our students who are now adults working with us in a wide variety of ways. You know, we were making them assistants to the teachers. Some of them were teaching assistants, headmasters, and those kinds of things just to keep them in the fold because there was no place really for them to go. And we now have, you know, all of these adult theater kids that wanted to stay in the theater. So that was one part of it. And then the second part happened out in New York. I went to a conference where I learned about sensory immersive theater. And I also learned that there were disability theaters for adults across the nation. And I had a very strong feeling about starting one in Milwaukee after that experience out in New York. And then like the third thing was just that when you do look around the theater community, there is a expectation of what it should look like. And at that point in time in my life, I was like, well, why does it have to look like this? Why can't it look like something else? So I talked to my husband and he encouraged me to quit my job and start the company. And we did kind of on a wing and a prayer and it's been thriving ever since.
Oh, thank you so much for that backstory. And then fast forward to the spring, along comes the Ruth Grant Foundation awarding Pink Umbrella Theater Company this grant. What was going through your mind when you learned that you had won this award?
Oh my goodness. The initial response was just the sudden sense of overwhelm, but that was combined with just a huge feeling of validation. And when I shared the news with our community, I cannot tell you how many of our actors and artists who identify with a disability just came back and said, we've been seen, we've been heard. They want us to do more. What are we going to do? What can I write? You know, there was just such a sense of validation within the community in which we work that I still get a little teary and overwhelmed, you know, when I think about the potential for where this funding is going to take this company.
Wow. So you also must have felt a bit of trepidation there that now it's real. You have to, there are resources now that you really have to turn on and put them into action. How does that feel?
Yeah, so the check actually between you and me, it came yesterday, and I think I threw up in my mouth a little bit. I just was like, this is real, and Ruth Arts has really made it possible for us to stabilize our workforce and then grow. So some of that money is earmarked to hire a person who can help us with development and grants. That money is there. Some of that money is going to go for an artistic director who identifies with a disability. Some of it's going to go for finding a space to rent that is our own, that we can create and make it accessible because theaters in the city are not. And so, yeah, like trepidation for sure, but also mixed with excitement.
And how much is the grant amount?
It is a total of $200,000 over the course of 2 years. What I think is really great about Ruth Arts and the communication that they've given us is that they're very concerned. They don't want us to like just go out and spend all of that money. We need to make sure that we've got a plan and that we also have a plan to keep things going, right? This is
longevity.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like they don't want our smaller arts organization to tip, is what they call it, to tip over in the wrong way financially. And so we don't have to spend that money in 2 years, which is incredibly helpful as well. We can really plan and be strategic about how we're implementing the work.
Katie Cummings is with us, founder and executive director of Pink Umbrella Theater Company in Milwaukee, as we talk about expanding efforts to create plays inclusive to artists with intellectual or physical disabilities. Katie, how does your theater company then choose plays that are inclusive of artists with a wide range of disabilities?
We take all, you know, disabilities. There are theater companies across the nation that focus on, you know, one disability or another. We really have grown just by word of mouth. We are the first professional theater company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to pay actors and artists who identify with a disability and really like focus our work on that. And so we have found that by listening to the adults, right, who identify with disabilities, they shared with us initially that their stories were not heard, and that the theater canon, you know, the traditional theater canon of Shakespeare and musical theater and those kinds of things were not really written for their brains and bodies. And so we actually write all of our own shows. Mm. And we do that by hiring playwrights who identify with a disability and or pairing a disabled playwright up with a typically developing or a neurotypical human.
That's what stood out to me about your theater company, is that you have this collection of guest artists, you know, working with the company and bringing all of their thoughts and creativity. What impact does that have overall in the theater company?
People feel heard. They feel seen. I had a conversation with an actor recently. She works in a wide variety of companies, and she mentioned to me after rehearsal one evening that this is the first time that she felt that she didn't have to mask her emotional disability. She could just be herself in the rehearsal room. And it made her feel like she was able to be a better actor, because she was able to be not only vulnerable on stage and share the story, but just in rehearsals, she didn't have to pretend to be something that she wasn't, which is a recurring theme with a lot of actors and artists with disabilities, that they've chatted with me over the course of the past 5 years that they don't have to hide who they are when they hang out with us. And that's incredibly important and incredibly an incredible compliment, I think, to how we approach our work.
Yeah, such an impact. So what are your first steps as you look to expand the theater company's scope over the next 2 years? What are these stages like?
Yeah, so first is to breathe. Take a breath and figure out, you know, how to approach all of it. We are in 2024, we're kind of slated to really solidify the business plan, start looking for a person to fill in part-time as a development grant writer, start that search for an artistic director who identifies with a disability, and then also start the search for just a space, right? They're just a wide open space for us to create the work.
The space will mean so much to so many people. Oh, Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here.
And that is Katie Cummings, founder and executive director of Pink Umbrella Theater Company in Milwaukee.
It's festival season in communities around Wisconsin. Here's a crowd pleaser. The Great Wisconsin Cheese Festival kicks off today in Little Chute.
Cheese Festival has the music, the rides, the various kinds of entertainment, and of course, front and center cheese, lots of it, including a curd eating contest and cheese tastings.
Whether or not you can make it to Little Chute for the event, you may well have some thoughts on the subject of cheese, and we want to hear about it.
What's your favorite kind of cheese? What's your favorite way to eat it? Straight up, baked into a recipe, maybe on a sandwich.
Share your cheese favorites. You can even name the make and model of the best cheese. Call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Kate, I'm liking this. I got this cheddar Gruyere combo lately. Great for eating,
nice.
Melting sandwiches. Triple threat. You got any favorites lately?
I do. Horseradish cheddar, amping up my sandwiches.
Yeah,
love
how powerful is the horseradish here? Because there's a lot of variation
oh,
in the horseradish.
It's got some bite. It is good.
All right. Again, tell us about your favorite cheese at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.